Good morning. Welcome to the April 10th San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors meeting. Please rise and join me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, would you read the changes to the agenda, please?
Certainly. Amended item to board business. Item number 19, board appointments to 5 oversight boards. Staff is requesting appointment 3C on the staff report be amended to replace Lori Saldana with David Jewell for the City of Pismo Beach. Applications for Lenny Jones and Chris Iverson are also attached that were not available when the item went to print. Added item to closed session, 1 pending litigation, A, conference with legal counsel existing litigation, number 8, application of Pacific Gas and Electric Company for approval of ratepayer funding to perform additional seismic studies recommended by the California Energy Commission, California Public Utilities application number 10-01-014-3, and number 9, Los Osos Community Services District versus County of San Luis Obispo et al., Golden State Water. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement.
Very good. Thank you. The first item on the agenda this morning is consent, and I'll open it to the public for comments on the consent agenda. And I have one request to speak, Eric Greening.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening speaking on item 2. This is the resolution approving participation in the state local partnership program with Arts Obispo, otherwise known as the San Luis Obispo County Arts Council. And I'm very much in favor of your taking this step. It precedes the budgetary step where you decide the level of your match. And obviously the state's contribution has been going down, and the art communities and the Arts Obispo contribution to our lives keeps getting richer and richer all the time. They're finding new efficiencies now with the new executive director. They're saving somewhere between $18,000 and $19,000 a year on rent they were paying, and getting that right out into the county and taking more and more of a county-wide mission, which you can see in Paso Robles, for example, on the first Saturday of every month when there are more and more spaces taking part in the art happening up there. Anyway, as you prepare for the budget, I know the staff report simply and the resolution mention that your match can be in a range between $12,000 and $41,000. $41,000 was kind of the high water mark during flush times. For many years, $30,000 was the typical sort of standard match. My own suggestion is, given the two bookends of $12,000 and $41,000, you split the difference and plug in $26,500. That recognizes that we haven't yet emerged from the pain plan, but it also recognizes that as the state contribution goes down, our contribution goes up, and it recognizes that as we are working on the economic efforts and the cultural efforts that we're all undertaking, that Arts Obispo is a critical, important partner to have at the table and to show as high a level of support as we practically can at this particular time in our emergence from the pain plan. And after all, it's the artists who truly help us deal with pain and turn it into beauty. Thank you.
Interesting perspective. Thank you, Mr. Greening. That was my only request to speak on the consent calendar, so I'll bring it back to the board and ask my colleagues if they have any comments on consent.
I have none, sir. None, sir.
Supervisor Hill?
None, sir.
Supervisor Meacham?
None.
Mr. Teixeira? And I, too, have no comments. Relatively straightforward consent calendar this morning. So with that,
approval of the consent calendar.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Meacham, seconded by Supervisor Teixeira. Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
And Mr. Patterson?
Yes. Thank you. We'll move on to our presentation calendar, which is quite robust this morning, and I'm sure why many of you are here. So I'll entertain a motion for the...
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Thank you very much. Madam Clerk, roll call.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
And Mr. Patterson?
Yes. And the first item this morning is a resolution recognizing Susan E. Baker upon her retirement, and Supervisor Hill is going to read that. And is Ms. Baker?
She's right here.
She is.
Did she give her camera to somebody, hopefully? It's my pleasure to read this resolution honoring Susan Baker, who for the last few years has been the board secretary and also has other things that you'll hear in the in our resolution as well, honoring her in the county government. And let me begin with that. Whereas Susan Baker began working in Risk Management Division of the Administration Office in June 2001, and whereas Susan transferred to the Board of Supervisors Office in December of 2006 to serve as Secretary of the Board and has worked for and with 9 supervisors during her career and has found me to be the most difficult one. No. Whereas close. Susan has exhibited the wit, strength of character, endurance, whew, to coordinate the calendaring for 5 supervisors, 5 legislative assistants concurrently, as well as keeping meetings on schedule and directing everyone to their appointments. Whereas Susan has displayed exceptional organizational skills in running the office, with her proofreading ability has been invaluable. Susan served on the County Safety Commission in both of the departments for which she has worked. Susan has generously shared her considerable talent as a photographer to our benefit, photographing events and the board members, including those photographs of the board members displayed on the website and the photo display in the lobby outside. Where Susan was also on the Public Art Committee, which organized artwork to be displayed in the new government center, which I would say she did a good job, because we do have some really lovely things out in our lobby. She assumed the responsibility for maintaining the historic photograph display that you see out in the lobby of the past supervisors and initiated a search to find missing photos for the display. Susan has gone above and beyond using funds collected from the office to keep the board and legislative assistants supplied in coffee and kibble. Susan is retiring from the county and will enjoy spending her time proofing briefs for her husband, Daniel, camping, stargazing, and indulging in photography, and I also know reading a lot of good books because she's a very well-read woman. So now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered that the Board of Supervisors and the Legislative Assistants of the County of San Luis Obispo, State of California, does hereby recognize Susan Baker for the exceptional service as Secretary to the Board and wishes her the best in her retirement. Want to do a picture?
Photo op.
Yeah. Might as well get her to keep her up here for the photo op.
Right. I think so. You get here and get
your
Obscene gestures.
Shows a unanimous vote.
You want to hold this up for people?
Okay, yeah. There you go.
We're all going to be upstaged by the mascot.
I know.
Okay, one more.
What is that?
Video. It's a fox.
Is that here for you?
Yeah.
It's a kid fox.
Uh-oh.
It's a crime fox.
Where's the
orange. Okay, it's all yours, Ms. Baker. Here's your chance.
Do we get to make comments first, Mr. Chairman?
No, I think so.
She's going to preempt us.
She's going to preempt.
Well, supervisors, legislative assistant, and all, thank you so much for the opportunity to work for the board for this past 5 years. I really appreciated it and hope that any little success I've had is really due to many people that there's too many of which really to thank. But I would like to thank a few, if you can indulge me. As Sherry Espiro said, and when I took this job 5 years ago, she said, there is no other job like this in the county. And she was correct. There is no other job like this in the county. So I would like to thank, first of all, my coworker, Fran Zahns, who is an amazing person, as you all know. And with her wisdom or wit and her institutional knowledge of the board, has helped me through many a hard time. And she's always supported me 100%, 100% of the time. And next, Chris Maychek of Planning and Building, Leanne Detweiler of Public Works. These two ladies have made the impossible possible for me with everyone's very complicated schedules, and I want to express my thanks to them. Rick Monroe, quarterbacking the maintenance folks and the custodial folks with all of our myriad complaints and requests for too hot, too cold, this sticks, this doesn't work. They always respond so well in making the board as comfortable as possible, as quickly as possible. The entire tech support staff people that help me with my real and imagined problems, Lotus Notes, as well as the board's myriad of problems, technical problems as well. And John Blankenship, who has willingly partnered with me to first set up the pictures of the Board of Supervisors and then maintain them. Despite his hectic schedule, he's always been there to help me. And then finally, last but not least, I want to thank my husband, Dan Marotek, who is my true life's compass, and it always points me in the direction I need to go. Thank you all very much. I couldn't express it as well as I would like, but I do appreciate everyone's efforts. Thanks.
Susan, hold on a sec.
We're not.
Supervisor Gibson.
We're not gonna let this chance pass here.
He's asked to comment.
We're gonna miss you, Susan. Those of you in the audience or listening know that when you call the board, you get a friendly voice. When you show up in our lobby for a meeting, you get a smiling face. Behind the wall, behind the scenes, there is at times chaos. You can imagine Susan trying to get two supervisors, two legislative assistants, half a dozen people who want a meeting to find a day within this century that can happen. It's no mean feat. And I've seen her staring blankly at her screen, scratching her head, wondering how in the world are we going to get six people in the room together, especially when supervisors then casually invite somebody to drop by that isn't on the schedule, who Susan may or may not know. But I have always appreciated your good humor and your smile in the morning when we come in, and I wish you the very best as you go forward, Susan. Thank you.
And as Susan, I too want to express my personal appreciation. I know it's difficult to really, as Supervisor Gibson said, and as you've expressed, to sort it all out among us and try to make it convenient for the public to find time for us. And I really appreciate the challenges that you faced on a daily basis dealing with the 10 of us. We have our legislative assistants in the mix as well, interfacing with them as well as us to make our jobs easier and to really serve the public the way you have. So thank you, and I know you're going to enjoy retirement, and I'll be cheering for you all the way. Supervisor Teixeira would also like to comment. And
Thank you, Chairman Patterson. Being the newbie on the board, it was a great awakening to come and find somebody that was as organized and had her act together and could help with the whole myriad of things that you come as a new supervisor. She's very organized, she's very intent, and she does her job very well. And if you don't believe me, just ask any of the county staff that happens to be in for a meeting, and when she walks in and tells you the meeting's over, they're already stepping out the door because they know.
Yeah.
That's it. You've had your time. It's it. Susan, you've done a wonderful job. You've helped Deb and I immensely. We appreciate everything you've done. We appreciate everything you've done for the county. Enjoy your retirement. Don't read too much. And tell Dan to read his own briefs.
All right. Supervisor Meacham.
I don't think you could characterize it any better than you heard cats. I mean, and that's basically what you do. I've kind of termed Susan as the hook. As Paul had mentioned, when the time comes to get out of the meetings, she is standing at the door, saying, your time is up. And the hook comes, and they're gone. And she keeps everything moving along real well. I encourage you to read a lot more books.
Yeah.
I think it's wonderful, and the photography as well. And thanks for your assistance in showing me how to work the camera. Appreciate that. And good luck to you.
Thank you all very much.
Supervisor Hill,
Final goodbye, and we... it's always hard to replace somebody who's helped to keep the operations running, so we know that there'll be a gap there. Perhaps you could talk to our friend the fox on your way out and see, encourage, finally, a mascot for us. But we will miss certainly the hook, which sometimes we had to tell her, come early with the hook. But we wish you well, and we thank you for all the work that you've done for us and also for the other division in the county, risk management.
Thank you all, supervisors. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah, you're up. Now we have a resolution recognizing National Telecommunicators Week, and Supervisor Meacham is going to read that.
Thank you. Who's going to be coming up to the fire and the police guys? Okay. This is a resolution proclaiming April 8th to the 14th, 2012, as the San Luis Obispo County National Public Safety Telecommunications Week, basically our dispatchers. Whereas Congress of the United States has established the second full week of April as National Telecommunicators Week, and the County of San Luis Obispo considers the services of the public safety telecommunicators to be vital to the interest of the community, San Luis Obispo Sheriff dispatchers answer an average of 2,362 911 calls a month, and county fire dispatchers add an average of 187 911 calls a month. I think Susan got, I don't know how many 911 calls for supervisor. Whereas the professional public safety telecommunicator is that vital link between the citizen or the victim and the public safety provider who may apprehend a criminal, save or recover their possessions, save their life, or their life of a loved one. And whereas public safety dispatchers are the single vital link for our law enforcement officers, firefighters, and emergency medical service providers by monitoring their activities by radio, providing them information, and ensuring their safety. And public safety dispatchers of the County of San Luis Obispo Sheriff's Office have contributed substantially to the apprehension of criminals and treatment of patients. And each public safety dispatcher has exhibited compassion, understanding, and professionalism during the performance of their duties during the past year. And now, therefore, it be it resolved and ordered that the Board of Supervisors does hereby designate the week of April 8th through April 14th, 2012, as the San Luis Obispo County National Public Safety Telecommunicators Week, and join in honoring the men and women whose diligence and professionalism keep our county and citizens safe.
They're going to bring them up after they speak.
Thank you for that, Supervisor Meacham. Maybe we can have all of our dispatchers present come up front along with Reddy Fox. Now, you might have to retake that picture with Susan because one supervisor was distracted from the moment Reddy Fox came in the room.
Just having Reddy Fox get the Supervisor Hill.
Is he wearing sunglasses? What is
safety glasses.
Safety glasses.
Safety glasses.
Safety glasses. Thank you for honoring dispatchers today. I'm going to start and then turn it over to Rick. Dispatchers truly are the unsung hero. You mentioned some of the things that they do. They are a critical link between the safety of our citizens and the safety of our deputies in the field and employees. And they do a tremendous amount of service, and including, I think, highlighting providing emergency medical information over the telephone on a regular basis. They are our front line of support. They're our first line of contact in many cases, and we're very fortunate to have an outstanding dispatch center. Not all of them are here in either center, but we're very fortunate to have them, and it's definitely an honor to get up here and recognize them because they certainly deserve it. So thank you.
And just to add on to what Sheriff Parkinson says, these folks are the first line. The public calls in, and these folks are the ones that have to understand what that person is saying on the phone, break it down as quickly as possible, and then provide that information to the officers and to our firefighters out in the field. This is where the public comes in, and this is our first point of contact. Without these folks, without the fine job that they do day in and day out, night in and night out, it would break down. So I want to say thank you also for this week and honoring these folks. They are truly the unsung heroes. We don't see these folks on TV. We don't see them getting the recognition, but these are the folks that make us better. And I want to say thank you also for that.
I'm getting down there to get a picture with Reddy.
Yeah, I know.
Change sides here.
Dispatched from both sides. Right. Right. This is the only perk he refers to in this job.
Bring Reddy back over here. I just want to get a little bit of a rough.
Just get around there. You go.
Ready.
Yeah. Easy. No, they're not. That's a windshield. We have.
Dr. Penny Bornstein, if she would come forward to a lectern, I would be pleased to read the following resolution. Whereas, each year, chronic diseases such as heart disease, cancer, and diabetes are responsible for millions of premature deaths and cause Americans to miss 2.5 billion days of work, resulting in lost productivity totaling more than $1 trillion. And whereas the month of April is National County Government Month, and this year's theme is Healthy Counties, Healthy Families. And whereas in celebration of this year's theme, the County of San Luis Obispo is bringing awareness to the abundance and variety of local resources available to help us all prevent disease and live healthier lives. And whereas the County Public Health Department, in honor of National Public Health Week, just celebrated April 2nd through the 8th, has assembled many of these local resources into a convenient online portal called Gateway to Health, available through www.slowpublichealth.org. And whereas residents are encouraged to access the Gateway to Health to find inspiration and local resources to support healthy lifestyle choices for themselves and their family. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim April 2012 as National County Government Month and encourages people in San Luis Obispo County, in the spirit of this year's theme, Healthy Counties, Healthy Families, to observe this month by taking preventative measures in big ways and small for yourselves and your families to live longer and healthier lives. Dr. Bornstein.
Well, thank you. Penny Bornstein, the County Health Officer. I'd just like to say a few words to tack on to what Supervisor Gibson read. The Public Health Department does indeed have a broad range of programs and services aimed at protecting and promoting the public's health. We also recognize that many county programs and organizations, private and public, do a lot in our county to promote healthy living and provide opportunities for eating fresh and healthy food. With this bountiful opportunity for recreation and fresh locally grown food, you would think that we would do better than we do, but we are still striving to push our way up in the county rankings. County health rankings were just released. We are number 13 overall, number 15 for health behaviors among the counties in the state. So we've got some work to do, and together we hope that we can all get there. To aiming for number one. Indeed, we have started a new outlet for people to get general information. It has activities that are happening in April for Healthy County, Healthy National County Government Month. And we have partnered with a number of private agencies and from the public side, Parks and Recs, Farm Bureau, Agriculture and Social Services. We have mentions on our website of all the ways in which, through those organizations, we can strive to be healthier. Again, it's slowpublichealth.org for the month of April on the county's homepage. You can also find that link. And I challenge each one of us to take a moment during this month and ongoing, but particularly now, to stop and think about one small thing that you can do every day this month. Take the stairs in this building, go for a walk at lunchtime, choose the fruit instead of the chips. Just one small thing that you can do to lead us all toward healthier living in San Luis Obispo County.
Dr. Borenstein, thank you. And I'm not so sure that eating the fruit instead of the chips is a small thing.
Yeah,
we may have to work up to that, but I wanted to thank you for making the effort to really bring this to the public's attention, and you did provide a very well-written op-ed in the Tribune April 1st when this activity started, and I encourage people to maybe take a look at that article, but also it mentioned that you would be adding daily tips on the website. Will that continue through the month, or is that just for Public Health Week?
That was for Public Health Week, but we are continuously trying to beef up our Facebook followers, likers, and so on at least a weekly basis, we do send out public health information.
Very good. Thank you very much. Moving on to our next presentation, you're all sitting quietly and patiently, and I very much appreciate that. A lot going on in April and May, and especially lots of activities and events and causes to recognize, and I have the pleasure of reading a resolution proclaiming diverse ideas and points of view that help us better understand each other and ourselves. And librarians are trained professionals helping people of all ages and backgrounds find and interpret the information they need to live, learn, and work in a challenging economy. And whereas librarians design and offer programs to meet their community's economic needs, providing residents with resume writing classes, interviewing workshops, and job-seeking resources. And whereas libraries are part of the American dream, places for education, opportunity, and lifelong learning. And whereas libraries, librarians, library workers, and supporters across America are celebrating National Library Week, now therefore be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim April 8th through 14th, 2012, as National Library Week in San Luis Obispo County, and encourages all county residents to visit their local library physically or online to take advantage of the wonderful library resources available. So, there you go. Brian or Margaret, do you want to receive this? And do we have... we have an opportunity for another photo op. And Supervisor Gibson, I understand that you have some...
Indeed, Mr. Chairman, District 2 is very well represented here. We have the president of the Friends of the Cayucas Library, Ms. Vera Wallen. We have Jerry Farrell and entourage, Friends of the Cambria Library, which, of course, is that group in particular is hard at work getting a new branch in place.
We have one more coming.
No pomo.
Yes. All right. Very good. Very good. Good. Brian or Marcus, would you like to say a few words? And also, when we're...
Thank you, Supervisors. Margaret Esther, Assistant Library Director, and we'll have Jerry Farrell from Cambria here, and then Brian will finish up. Thank you for the opportunity to acknowledge and recognize our public libraries. As you can see, there's more public here than librarians. So it is a public service day in and day out. We are there 24/7 on the internet for information, for service, and as the whole list of things that happen at the public libraries, we do encourage everyone, whether you have a library card or not, they're free for all the people sitting in the audience, or all the people who are watching or listening at home. Stop by your public library in San Luis Obispo County. We are excited to be there.
Gentlemen, Jerry Farrell, Friends of the Cambria Library. And for Cambria, this isn't just Library Week, it's Library Year. And we really believe we're going to go the whole route. And we thank you all for your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your hard work. Brian, did you want to say something? And
just
we have a representative also from the Library Foundation that would like to speak
yes.
at some point.
Brian Reynolds, County Library Director. I'm very biased about this, but I think libraries are one of the best things we do in government and in society. There's many ways to think about them, books, computers, buildings, and programs. But I think the best aspect by far is the people, the staff and the public who use the libraries and by their dint of their hard work help us all be smarter. I'm particularly grateful for the Friends of the Library and the Library Foundation because they every day are showing how much libraries matter. And that's a very big deal, and I'm very proud and honored to be a small part of what they do. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. And Vera Wallen, who is president of the Foundation for San Luis Obispo County Libraries. Vera?
Right, and no longer president of the Cayucas Friends, but, of course, a member of the Friends. So, but I am president of the Foundation for the San Luis Obispo County Libraries. And I want to talk to you about support for libraries. I know if I asked people to raise their hands, and I won't do it because I used to be a school teacher and I used to make people do that all the time, and I go, okay, Vera, don't do that. But we all use libraries one way or another. We send our children or our grandchildren, or we're there ourselves, or we go online. There's many things that we do. We've got people in our community who are contributing to our public library system during these hard times, and it's really important. As you well know, there's been a 17% cut in library staff since 07, which we can look at as the good year. Got to bet with him. When I'm 100, which is 30 years from now, I'm going to be 100 years old, they're still going to be out there. In fact, there's going to be even more use. So we need to know that because that is what's coming forward. Maybe a little bit different way, that's okay. But with our friends, with our volunteers, and I'm supposed to be volunteering at Cayucas right now, and then with all the librarians, and I heard mention of the librarians, it's really important for you to recognize the importance of those people. And some of them you don't see. I just learned about someone named Marianne Gold who passed away at 94. She worked in your library back when you were over by where the little theater is now. For 23 years, she worked there. And people didn't see her, so they said, oh, no, she wasn't a librarian. Oh, yes, she was. She was up there processing all the books properly, getting Black Gold system to work so that we can share books amongst the libraries. Those kinds of things are going on by these people all the time. And they're your people. They're our people. So we need to work together with that. So I really want to thank you for doing this and to say from the foundation, this is so important. Keep it up.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Wallen. And I have to... We appreciate the work that the foundation does for all of our libraries as well as our friends groups. I hold my office hours in three different libraries in my district, and I have to tell you, they're busy places. Even in the remote communities of Creston and the small community of Santa Margarita, there are always people going in and out of those libraries. And in those smaller rural communities, the libraries are really a meeting place for members of the community, so they serve that function as well. And as we all know, I want to thank my colleagues on the board, as well as admin and general services and the library department, for working together. While many counties throughout the state of California are reducing their library services and in some instances closing their libraries, we're building two new libraries in San Luis Obispo County, one in Atascadero and one in Cambria. And it's because we all throughout the county see the value of libraries to our community, and it's the effort of county admin and general services and the library department and the friends who are essential partners in creating these new libraries and maintaining services countywide that we're able to do this. So I think that we are, San Luis Obispo County, are on a pedestal when it comes to providing library services for our residents. So thank you for all the work that you do. Mr. Chairman,
if I could echo your thanks to colleagues and to the remarkable partnership of the Library Department, the Foundation, and the local Friends groups. And I wonder if you might indulge me in a shameless plug for the Cambria Friends of the Library. If President Farrell might come back to the lectern just briefly to talk about the fundraising event that's happening in Cambria on Saturday night. You know, if you got airtime, we might as well.
Ooh, me? Talk yes, about fundraising?
Yes, ma'am.
We have David Udevin presenting an event this Saturday at the Vets Hall, and he'll be talking about his swimming adventures. He's a world-class swimmer all around the world. And, of course, our book sales that are four times a year in May and our treasure sale in June. But this Saturday should be a really great event. Happy hour. Social hour at 5 and dinner at 6, lasagna dinner. Tickets are $35. Join us. It will be a very good evening.
Contact number?
924-1814. That's me, Jerry. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Oh, absolutely. Thank you all for being here. And Supervisor Meacham.
While we're talking about benefits, later this month we're going to be having a fashion show at Robert Hall Winery to get the funds together for the Templeton Library that they're trying to put together. So this will be the third year we're doing that, and I get to be the MC, so I get to talk about all the wonderful models that we're going to have, including my legislative assistant.
Our legislative assistants
exactly.
Are part of that effort. So, interesting. All right, one more. Thank you for bearing with us and being patient. Another very important activity and month to recognize Supervisor Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson. This resolution is proclaiming April 2012 as Sexual Assault Awareness Month and April 28th as Walk a Mile in Her Shoes Day in San Luis Obispo County. Whereas Sexual Assault Awareness Month is intended to draw attention to the fact that sexual violence is widespread and has public health implications for every community member of San Luis Obispo County, and whereas staff and volunteers of the Sexual Assault Recovery and Prevention Center of San Luis Obispo County encourage every person to speak out when witnessing acts of violence, however small, and whereas with leadership, dedication, and encouragement, there is compelling evidence.
And I might say that traditionally members of the board do participate in that event, and we all try to compete to see who gets the best looking shoe.
Thank you to the Board of Supervisors for this proclamation. My name is Christy McCray. I'm the Executive Director of the Sexual Assault Recovery and Prevention Center. Sexual Assault Awareness Month is a mouthful to say, but it is a nationwide event, and I'm really proud and encouraged that for another year, San Luis Obispo County is also a part of this movement to end sexual violence. Last year, the SARP Center served 286 men, women, and teen survivors of sexual assault. We also provided our services to more than 130 loved ones because sexual assault doesn't affect just the survivor. We know that it affects our whole county, our family, our friends, our coworkers, our whole community. This is why we go into schools, businesses, and other organizations to provide prevention education, making sure that people are aware of our services. We provide 24-hour crisis services, counseling services, and then we also do prevention. And teaching folks how sexual assault can be reduced. Our agency's vision is to create a world that is free of sexual violence, and we need your help and everyone's help to do this. The SARP Center encourages county residents to participate in any or all of our awareness-raising activities this month, including self-defense workshops, a tamale cooking class, community yoga, and we have lots of fundraisers at local restaurants and businesses. We'll also be participating in partnership with Cal Poly's SAFER program at Take Back the Night in Farmers Market April 26th. And, of course, Sexual Assault Awareness Month culminates with Walk a Mile in Her Shoes. This is our 10th annual, which I'm really excited about. We'll be having it in Mission Plaza with a family fun fair from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And we really encourage everyone to come out and get involved. At the very least, you're going to get to see your supervisors walking in bright red high heels.
They make them in size 14.
We have up to size 15, so I think we've got everyone covered. But more importantly, Sexual Assault Awareness Month is about honoring survivors, whether they've told their story or not. It's time for us to raise awareness and destroy myths that make it difficult for survivors to talk about their experiences. I also want to acknowledge the SARP Center staff, our volunteers, and our board of directors. This is not an easy field to work in, and I am honored every day to work with such a dedicated and committed group of people who provide compassion to those in our community who need it the most at some of their most traumatic times. Thank you again for this proclamation, and I hope to see you guys all on the 28th.
Yeah. We'll be there. Thank you very much for the important work you do. It's critical and meets needs of people in need. So thank you. With that, we've concluded the presentation portion of our agenda, and we'll go into public comment for items not on today's agenda. And I have quite a few requests to speak. I'll call your name, please. Come forward. When I call your name, and we'll move through this part of the agenda, hopefully expeditiously. First up is Richard Margetson, followed by Gwen Taylor. Mr. Margetson?
Richard Margetson. You missed an interesting meeting at the RAC last week. The Recycled Water Management and Conservation Plan we've asked to be reviewed by somebody came up for discussion at the RAC during public comment. Mr. Ogren and a staff member came and gave preliminary comments at the beginning of public comment, and then it was opened up to the public. Mr. Ogren stated that he didn't believe the RAC should look at this. He provided that weren't part of the packet, a letter from 2009 that the RAC had prepared, and an update sheet from staff on the recycled plan, neither of which were in the packet, as I said, for the meeting, so nobody had any advance warning of what was coming. One of the things that was very interesting, Mr. Ogren said, was that if the RAC looked in on current of keeping this from the RAC, Mr. Ogren decided not to answer, walked out of the room. Your public works director walked out of the room on the rack when asked a question that might have been a little too hard for him to answer or come up with the appropriate response. And I don't know why you'd want to look at this document, but I've given you another example today of flaws in this document that are throughout it, that staff prepared at the cost of hundreds of thousands of dollars. If you look at the document that's on the overhead, I circled the number in the second column. Now, we have some professed math experts on the board. Please, somebody tell me how an average of averages ends up being a total of averages, and how 5,581 customers times 7,004 gallons per day equals 1,676. If that's correct, that number should be 39 million gallons.
Mr. Morgenson.
All through this document.
Gwen Taylor, followed by Linda Yuan.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I'm a resident of Los Osos. Since last year, members of the RAC, which is a Water Conservation Advisory Committee, and members of the public have asked for a report by the RAC on the Los Osos Recycled Water Plan, with only promises that it would be agendized for an update and a discussion at some future time. In March, a member of the agricultural community attended the RAC expecting a discussion of the Los Osos recycled water, as was part of the agenda. They had, excuse me, the discussion was supposed to be that morning or afternoon, but it was postponed even after this board had approved a recycled water participation program on October the 20th, 2011. On November 2011, a draft recycled water management plan was out and available for review and discussion. This plan was not agendized for the RAC. The RAC members and the public expected to have the plan agendized by the first of the year. It was not agendized until March and then postponed. A water engineer for Golden State Water Company attended the April meeting with the expectation of a discussion of the recycled water usage for Los Osos, since they had been blindsided on March the 20th with the agreement of the school board on recycled water usage. Pavo Ogren used the meeting to let this be an excuse for not hearing it at the RAC. The RAC is supposed to be an organization committee, if you wish, for all of the areas within the county regarding water. The recycled water management plan or any discussion regarding recycled water for Los Osos as agendized for April should have been heard, and it was not. You cannot expect the public to regard the RAC with any credibility if three times in 1 year, February, March, April, they agendize an item and then postpone it and the public comes to hear the discussion. You don't get respect.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Lindy Owen, followed by Julie Tacker.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from the Prohibition Zone in Los Osos, where my toilet pollutes but the neighbors doesn't. I wanted to bring up another example of how Mr. Gibson, Mr. Pavo Ogren, your public works director, and your staff that's working on this wastewater project has done little to nothing to bring the project cost down or to give us appropriate technology. One serious problem that's going on is the restoration of the Tri-W project. That was the prior project where the sewer was going to be in the middle of town, where it wasn't going to stink and it wasn't going to be seen, blah, blah, blah. Well, a group of people who I'm proud to have been part of stopped that project from going in there. And now the funds set aside by Mr. Ogren and the staff to restore the project. If you look up in the dictionary, restore means to bring back to what it was. You know, 11 acres of land, that's going on a sewer bill. It doesn't belong there. It did not have a fence around it before. And secondly, now it's going to have little paths with little wire walkways to keep people from getting into the planting that's also going to be involved. That did not exist before. Very quickly, I really want to talk about technologies. This is what we used to use back in the 1940s. It's called a typewriter. Now we use a computer. What we're talking about in the way of technology for this project is stuff that's left over from the 20th century. Gravity sewers are no longer being built wherever they can avoid them because of their serious problems. This one's going to leak in our drinking supply. That's pretty darn serious.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Julie Tacker, followed by Ben DeFada.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker from Los Osos, and I think I'm going to continue on with the theme of disrespect for Los Osos. Certainly at the RAC, Mr. Margetson and Ms. Taylor's comments, our water recycle management plan deserves a look by those informed individuals. The disrespect for the Tri-W site is glaring. The Santa Isabel Avenue project, its meandering pedestrian path is coming apart. The million-dollar project it's less than a mile. Over $1 million has been spent on some islands, some ADA curbs that go nowhere, and glow-in-the-dark bollards that are illuminated as your car drives by. It's a forest of bollards. This resin composite decomposed granite material was laid in a meandering path, but it had to wait some 4 months or so for the ambient temperature to reach a certain degree of Fahrenheit. The morning it was poured, it was 57 degrees on my car thermometer. And I actually called Dave Flynn afterwards and said, you know, it was too cold to lay that material. And he explained that they'd waited long enough, contractors had been waiting, the contracts were expiring, they needed to move ahead with the project. And in doing so, invalidated the manufacturer's warranty of that product. So here we are, less than 2 years later, and the material's coming apart. The pathway is pocked, cracked, a gravel that's dangerous and slippery is now there, and it's emblematic. This project is emblematic of the disrespect for Los Osos. Santa Isabel is a gateway avenue into our community, down to Baywood Park, the charming Baywood Park, and we have no recourse. County taxpayers will eventually end up paying for its repair or removal, and the project on whole is an embarrassment. I wanted to bring this to your attention today because I think it is a dangerous situation. But again, I am concerned, certainly as the wastewater project moves forward, that the disrespect to the people of Los Osos continues.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Ben DeFada, followed by Eric Meyer.
Morning, Chairman Patterson, Board, Sheriff, and public. Today's subject is show and tell, as you can see, and the old and the new. And in the old days, we had to put the film in the camera, in the holder, in the dark, and put it in the camera. We had to shoot. We had to focus. We had to do a lot of things. And that was the best it was in them days. Today's professional camera costs $600. That camera cost $600 in 1950, by the way. Cost $600, light, great quality, 10 pictures, and be nice to put it on. 10 pictures in 10 seconds. Be nice to take the lens off. But so today, if you were to choose a camera, which one would you choose? It's not a contest. It's a no contest. And that's what we're getting with this gravity sewer. That's the whole idea of the show and tell. The same for Gibson and Auburn's gravity sewer project. Their antiquated gravity collection project is the same as this big antiquated heavy camera spending for the sewer, thus making more people dependent on government here in our own backyard. That's what your district voters will get if they vote for you two in a few months. Why don't you do the right thing for us? Anyway, that's the whole idea. This is a whole antiquated camera. You don't want to use it today. Not many people can use it. And yet you still want to go forth with that lousy gravity sewer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeFatto. Eric Meyer, followed by Heather Helm.
Hi, my name's Eric Meyer. I'm not from Los Osos, and I'm not talking about Los Osos. I'm talking about the future and progress. I'm here to discuss the potential property available over a path that the county might know as the San Juan, or as the Juan Bautista de Anza Trail between Pismo and San Luis Obispo. Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, or Supervisors, I'm a planning commissioner from the city of SLO, and I'm also the chair of the Land Use and Circulation Element Update in that city, but I'm not here in that capacity. I'm here as a private citizen. Last week, over a mile of old Pacific Coast Railway came up for sale. While I realize the county process normally requires much time to acquire land, I believe that between SLOCOG and County Parks Commission, there are funds to make this acquisition available for these one-mile parcels. The trick is getting the temporary funding to get the deal done before a private party buys these parcels and the extremely poor homes on them become income property. These level parcels extend from just south of the Country Club area down behind Edna, across Pice Canyon Road, and down into PXP, or Plains Exploration Oil. The purchase of the old railroad right-of-way would dramatically speed up the development of a Class 1 commuter bike trail between Pismo and SLO, perhaps by decades. A trail in this location is mentioned in many county documents. Most specifically, it's in the 2010 update of the County Bikeways Plan at the same priority as the Bob Jones Trail. This trail is described in the Parks and Rec element as part of the Juan Bautista de Anza Trail, a national parks-level trail from Mexico to San Francisco. It's also described in the 1984 Edna Isle Pacific Plan. To the north of the segments that are for sale right now, 60% of the distance between downtown San Luis and this segment is Class 1 bike path right now. 39% is Class 2 bike path. Only 1% is not a bike path. That's 3,000 feet, owned by two owners. To the south of the parcels that are for sale, the county already has offers of dedication for over one-third of the way from the old, I forget what it's called, that particular development, King's Development. And other than that one-third, the other two-thirds are owned by two different parties, and there are ways around and over those two different parties. So after the purchase of these old Pacific Coast Railway parcels, we only need to deal with five other parties to gain the entire right-of-way between Pismo and SLO. I've been in meetings with SLOCOG, the City of SLO, City of Pismo, Air Pollution Control District, Land Conservancy, Bicycle Coalition. All these parties will offer letters of support or resolutions of support to SLOCOG. Most importantly, I've had extensive conversations with Ron DeCarli and SLOCOG planners in order to figure out how to finance it. I've also been working with Adam Hill and many county departments. What I need is for you, Mr. Chairman, to have this item placed on a future board agenda and have staff prepare a resolution of support to sign and forward to SLOCOG. This resolution should also request funds from SLOCOG for the purchase of rights away and a feasibility study through Price Canyon in concert with Air Pollution Control District and other appropriate environmental agencies. In the meantime, I need you to direct staff to arrange for a more complete discussion between myself, County Public Works, okay, County Parks, SLOCOG, et cetera.
Your time is up. Right. I encourage you. It sounds all very good, and I'm encouraged by the fact that you are working with Supervisor Hill, and maybe we can continue to move this forward. Thank you. Okay. Heather Hellman, followed by Eric Greeney.
Thank you, Heather Hellman, San Luis Obispo. I'm the event director for the inaugural Slow Marathon, Half Marathon, and 5K that's taking place April 22nd. My company, Get Off the Couch Potato Sports Productions, based here in San Luis Obispo, has been producing events in our community for nearly 3 years now. We are the producers of the Central Coast Cancer Challenge, a trail running and cycling event that has raised $25,000 for cancer support charities in the past 2 years. We have been working on the Slow Marathon, first conceptually and now into production, for more than a year. Our vision is to create a world-class event that attracts athletes from all over the globe to come to San Luis Obispo to experience what we all love about the slow life. The sport of running has grown over the past decade, and distance running leads the way. Running is an easy way to start or maintain a healthy lifestyle. We started out attracting 1,200 half marathoners and 500 marathoners. In January, we realized we were going to eclipse those numbers, so we nervously raised to 800 marathoners and 2,000 half marathoners. A little over a week and a half, we know anybody who comes here will want to come here again and visit, possibly on vacation. In this inaugural year, we've also partnered with two fundraising charities, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, through their team and training program. I don't know how much they've raised, but I've participated in events before, and they raised nearly, close to $800,000, $1 million for a cure for blood cancers. We're also, our 5K race is benefiting the local Special Olympics chapter here, and we're happy to contribute to them. I just want to say we hope that all the positives that the San Luis Obispo Marathon and Half can bring to our whole community, like a healthy lifestyle, a large economic impact, and charitable giving, will outweigh the temporary inconveniences of the day. Okay. We're looking forward to April 22nd and hope you are too.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you
for your efforts. Supervisor Hill.
Yeah, I just wanted to throw in a comment, and I'm glad we did have some concerns with residents. We have worked out everything with the organizers and with city and county so that there will be traffic controls and folks will be able, with as Ms. Hellman said, with minimal inconvenience, be able to come and go in their neighborhoods. But it is a great event that I think everybody's excited to have in our community. This is a community that we want to see more outdoor athletes coming to visit, so we thank you.
Yes. Eric Greening, followed by Al Barrow.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and nobody likes to hear told you so, but years ago, when the county took the Los Osos project from the CSD, I predicted that a hugely disproportionate share of your board time would be spent on the 6% of the county's population from Los Osos. That has obviously been the case, and I don't fault the people of Los Osos for coming here to speak to their issues, even when it makes up a large part of public comment. Usually I spend my own comments on other issues that are also of interest to the 94% of the people in this county who are not from Los Osos. But as a member of the Water Resources Advisory Committee, I have to join the chorus today. We were put in an untenable position at our last meeting. As a little background, as much as a year ago, last March 2011, we received an update, just a progress report, not contents, on the recycled water management plan, which gave us the understanding that it was within our purview, that it would come to us and then go to the board and then go to the Coastal Commission. Of course, it went to neither us nor the board before it went to the Coastal Commission, but it was our understanding at our March meeting that at our request we would be linked to it online and have it on our agenda to discuss. It was taken off the agenda. Okay, it's off the agenda. Then we have what amounts to a staff presentation on it. Two members of Public Works staff with written materials about it handed to us. This is about a meeting about an item that was taken off by some mysterious not on our agenda. Essentially, we were maneuvered into the position of being culpable. And don't forget, the Brown Act is criminal. And the criminals are the people on the decision-making body. Had we done anything whatsoever, I asked, please stop what amounts to a staff presentation, agendize it for next month, bring it back. I didn't want to discuss it. We were getting staff presentation. We were getting public comment. We were getting written materials. We could do nothing legally, legitimately about any of this. We did have an item at the end of the meeting, future agenda items. We took an action to request that this legitimately be placed on our agenda next month. I hope it is. If staff wants to argue we should take no action, let them argue. If the public wants to argue that we should, let them argue. Let us decide. But don't put us in this untenable position. It either is on or it isn't. And why can't it be on? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Alvaro, followed by Martha Golden.
Good morning. I have some fresh cooked popcorn for your text messaging sessions today, Adam. So that's organic white corn. Do you enjoy that text messaging with some delicious popcorn? Anyway, I would like to talk about the points of the bid documents that was announced last week. And several engineers has not complied with. The language states that that's a requirement, that they must have read and understand all the language in this 712 pages, plus all the background legal requirements. Number four, the ability requirements for federally funded wastewater projects, the affordability requirements have not been met. 44% of the sewered area are renters, some with school children that qualify for free lunch programs. Schools lose $4,000 per student and may have to close another school in Los Osos or lay off more teachers. Those are impacts that haven't been addressed. And many households owe more on their homes than they're worth, and many lost portions of their retirement. The lending guidelines have not been met. Borrowers have to show ability to pay and willingness to pay. This is a liar loan like the ones that destroyed our global economy. The USDA RUST funding application did not disclose the earthquake and liquefaction conditions. That is a violation and a misrepresentation of the sewer design. The engineers found that there was no adequate mitigation of ground lurching, soil subsidence, and liquefaction in the plans. 1 minute of collection system earthquake would destroy the whole thing, and $100 million would be required to replace it.
Thank you, Mr. Farrell. Martha Golden, followed by Giselle Naylor.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Ms. Golden.
Martha Golden. While I am a resident of Los Osos, and there, but my sewage does not have any aroma and has no polluting effects because I'm not in the prohibition zone. I have to concur with many of the remarks that people have made about the sewer project. However, that's not why I am here. I've been listening to things that sound a little bit like the county overall, various departments and the board have a slight antipathy towards open government. And so I had an interesting experience, which I thought I would bring to you. I wonder whether it's inadvertence, advertence, passive-aggressive attitude toward the public. Now, true confessions, I'm not a computer nerd. I'm antiquated, and therefore I just barely struggle through. However, in the past, when I wanted to know what was on the agenda at the Board of Supervisors and when I wanted to see the staff report that related to that particular item of interest to me, all I had to do was go to the Board of Supervisors, look at the agenda, find the current date that I was looking for, find the item, and there, right on the right-hand side, was an active link, and it said Staff Report. Click, on came the report. Well, a month ago I did that or thereabouts, and it worked. Badly, but it worked. A week ago I tried that. Forget it. There was no easy way to get to the staff report for the item I was interested in, but I wasn't coming to the meeting, so I gave up. Yesterday, remember, I'm not good at this. Yesterday, after 45 minutes of clicking on various cute little icons, I finally managed to download the report in zip form, which meant that my computer didn't like it, so I had to figure out how to get the darn thing open. And then, at last, after 45 minutes, I was able to do one thing with it. Couldn't copy it. It's encrypted. Couldn't email it to anybody. It's encrypted. I was able to print it. Hooray for me. But if I wanted to let anybody else know about it, there was no way I could do it. And since I hadn't memorized all the steps I had to take to get to this item, I couldn't tell anybody else how to do it. Now, why can't we go back to a good old-fashioned system that has an active link that says, staff report? Whee! You click on it, and you get the information that you need for an informed public to be, guess what, informed. Thank you.
Ms. Golden, I think others share that frustration. We did have a presentation on the new board presentation of the documents, and Julie Rotewald gave that to us in public session a week ago, and she did say that anyone having trouble can call their office and they'll walk them through it. So I encourage you to do that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I might add to that, too, and I know there was a couple of others that commented that maybe there's a potential for having some classes or something along these lines.
So tried to access documents related to the groundwater management plan on March 27th, during the March 27th meeting, and could not access them. I got error messages that I was unauthorized to read the documents. The documents were encrypted when I was able to download them. And then I couldn't download some of the documents because I got error messages that said cannot connect to the server. Apache 7.0 apparently is an application as well as a server that Oracle company uses, and it could be related to maybe a bad update coming from Adobe, but I could access other government website documents no problem. So putting stuff in PDF seems like the easiest way to go. But originally I wanted to speak to a March 27th agenda item number 17, which related to the groundwater management plan. I could not access those documents, and you were being asked to approve them earlier than the deadline date on March 27th. And also, you were asked to approve the establishment of a steering committee that would somehow be the liaison between the groundwater management entities and the outlying communities. So there may be some public notice requirements that have to be repeated if you've got problems, wherever the cause is, of the public not being able to access those important documents and contracts. I was able to download a specific 34-page contract that was specific to the Oceano Lagoon, where there, you know, there's a $78,000 contract to figure out how to alleviate flooding in the Oceano area. However, the contract is really vague as to what the purpose of the contract is and what they really are going to do. I mean, yeah, it says we're going to look at ways to alleviate flooding, but it doesn't say what they're going to do. It talks about doing ecological surveys and assessments of endangered species and plants, and then halfway through it, it says, oh, we're not going to do that part of the proposed contract. So they're going to, you know, investigate the substrata, I suppose, of the soil, and it looks like it would be great, you know, if they're going to develop down there, if they're going to put up housing or, okay, or, you know, close off, you know, the airport, but it doesn't really say what they're going to do. Okay. And I'm
thank you, Ms. Taylor.
I'm sorry,
Ms. Naylor, your time is up.
I've got five defects in the contract that I'd like to mention.
Okay, you may provide those to the clerk if you like. Mike Brown, followed by Gabe Garcia.
I want to talk about an assembly bill that's important, but vis-a-vis the data access, maybe one thing you could do is live like everybody else, and the board and the senior staff of the county would commit to receive its agenda materials, its planning commission materials, et cetera, through the public version electronically, dispense with all paper, all of you use it, and then you would know what it was like to get it that way as opposed to perhaps within the native system. Also, if you want to see a site that really works that I think everybody should try and emulate, it's Amazon. You can buy anything, you can do anything. It's a couple of clicks, and it's extremely intuitive. Now, there's a bill called AB 1627, the Healthy Neighborhoods Act of 2012, and it modifies sections 25402 of the statutes of the Public Resources Code, actually, to update that. The current code is pretty much about building efficiency and so forth, which most of the new construction meets. This leaps forward and adds a whole new potential set of requirements by directing the State Energy Commission to adopt regulations which would be mandates on cities and counties, and it would set standards for reducing vehicle miles traveled by occupants of buildings that would be applicable to all new residential buildings and non-residential buildings constructed at some date after its adoption. Cities and counties would be forbidden from issuing a building permit for projects which don't comply. They would also be authorized and enabled to adopt more new fees, hire more staff, and cover the costs of review and monitoring these new requirements. Some of them would...
The marathon grows in the future to continue to support it and work with those residents. I'll share with you a personal perspective. I've run four marathons before, and each one I've gone out of the area to run, and I've spent at least $1,000 on each of those marathons. And on my last marathon, I said, I'm never doing this again. It's just too difficult, and I wasn't having any fun with it. And that was last year. And when the slow marathon was announced, this is my hometown, I said, I have to do it. It's just something, there was no doubt, I had to do it. And my company, I work for a company that has 80 individuals, and we have about 70 people participating in some fashion. We've got people handing out water at a water station. We've got about 55 runners. And throughout this whole process, my love for this town has grown. When I'm running out Edna Valley and just seeing the beautiful rolling hills, like, I just get such a great feeling, and so my mindset going into the marathon is so positive compared to the previous ones. And as the board just announced that April's going to be National Health Month, I think the marathon being in April supports that, and it just adds to the healthy living in San Luis Obispo County. So please continue to support the marathon in this town, and the current race map I think is a great course, because it shares both the downtown area of San Luis as well as the beautiful rolling hills. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Garcia, and we're pleased that you're able to stay here to do your running, and thank you, Ms. Hellman, for making that possible, and hopefully it'll catch on and get bigger and better every year. So thank you. That concludes my request to speak in public comment. We're going to take a short break and reconvene at 10:45. Great. Thank you. Welcome back. We'll proceed through the morning's agenda, and the next item appointments to the five oversight boards. Madam Clerk, do you want to introduce that, please?
Item 19, board appointments to five oversight boards that will review and approve the activities of the successor agencies of the former redevelopment agencies.
And Mr. Grant, this is
This is my item. Thank you. Jim Grant, County Administrator. Good morning. Yes, up on the board here, we have a quick PowerPoint that talks about Redevelopment Dissolution Act. Just a little bit of background. On February 1st, all redevelopment agencies in California, that's over 400 of them, were dissolved, and the process of unwinding their affairs began. So think of it as maybe a death in the family. Didn't leave a will. And now everybody has to get together and decide what to do with the assets of that that person's stuff. The reason for this is that it was really part of the governor's plan to balance the state budget by eliminating these redevelopment agencies and then redirecting the $5 billion-plus in property tax back to schools and other government agencies, including counties. And so part of this unwinding is appointing a persons to an oversight board, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But so in the county right now, we have five redevelopment agencies, or we did, that are now gone. And they were in the cities of Atascadero, Arroyo Grande, Grover, Paso Robles, and Pismo Beach. The county did not have a redevelopment agency, nor did Morro Bay or the city of San Luis Obispo. As the dissolution became effective, in order to unwind these affairs, a successor agency was to take the place of the former redevelopment agency in those cities that I mentioned. And for the most part, those cities took on those responsibilities as successor agencies. And what they're supposed to do, and in the process of doing right now, is of disposing of the former redevelopment agency assets and property. They're preparing budgets and pay for administrative cost. And all of those actions are subject to review by an oversight board, which we're here to talk about today. One exception to the successor agency is that the city of Pismo Beach decided not to become the successor agency, and so the governor appointed three residents in the area to become that successor agency. The actual oversight boards consist of seven members, as you see right here. The Board of Supervisors gets to appoint two members. The mayor of each city appoints one. The county and superintendent of schools appoints one. California Community Colleges has one appointee. And then the largest special district taxing. Recommended board appointments, there's one that's basically a general member, and each of the board members that has a former RDA in their area has stepped up and has agreed to become a member. So Supervisor Patterson for the Atascadero RDA, Supervisor Meacham for Paso, Supervisor Hill for Pismo and Grover, and Supervisor Teixeira for Arroyo Grande. And Supervisor Gibson gets to skate on this particular one. Lucky guy. In terms of public members, each board has a public appointee for each of the five oversight committees. We've got applications for the folks that you see right here. I won't actually read these off, but there are five that have stepped up and wanted to be part of the oversight boards, and they're here for your ratification today if you so choose to do so. And last, because the library district is the largest special taxing entity in three areas, the Atascadero area, Pismo, and Arroyo Grande area, I'm recommending that your board appoint Will Clements, who is part of Public Works as an administrator there, to be part of that, the Atascadero RDA. Dan Buckshy, the assistant county administrator, works for me for Pismo Beach RDA, and then Pavel Ogren, the director of Public Works for Arroyo Grande. I had Will Clements also on here for the Paso Robles Redevelopment Agency, but I've come to find out that the cemetery district is actually the largest taxing entity, and they've already made an appointment. So I'm recommending that you not appoint Will Clements to the Paso Robles one. And Grover Beach also has one. The biggest taxing entity there is the Grover Lighting District, and so they have an appointment for that particular area. So what does an oversight board do? Well, it's overseen by the State Department of Finance, but ultimately the oversight board takes a look at everything that the successor agency does and all the obligations, and then decides whether those are legitimate obligations to carry forward and pay forward for years to go. So the oversight board does their work. It goes to the State Department of Finance. They will oversee that work. And if that's all good and fine, the auditor has a big role in that. Then the auditor audits all of these finances by July 1 of this year. So the auditor's office has been working furiously over the last couple of months to get all this in place. If the appointments aren't made as of May 15th, the governor gets to make those appointments, but I don't think that's going to be the case. And then finally, on July 1, 2016, all oversight boards in the various areas and counties, say the five oversight boards here in San Luis Obispo County, get consolidated into one single wide oversight board. So it's not 25 people, it's not all of the oversight boards together membership. It's a new board with seven individuals on it, but that's to be decided in 2016. Again, the role of the auditor, he's got to conduct an audit of each former RDA's assets and liabilities. The state controller gets a copy of that, and then the auditor also annually determines and administers the allocation of the Redevelopment Property Trust Fund. And again, that will go on some years. Once those obligations are taken care of, then the money that has been going to those RDAs will then come back again to either the schools or the county or other governmental agencies as dictated by law. But it's not over, actually. Even though there are no RDAs now, there are 11 new bills that have been introduced. Many of them are tweaking the existing legislation. Probably the important ones out there deal with the low and moderate income for housing. And those we'll keep track of and report back to you as needed. But there's a lot of movement in the state legislature right now to change things around. And so it's a little chaotic at this point. But, again, we'll be back to talk about it with your board. So with that, I'm going to wrap it up and entertain any questions, but recommend that you appoint those individuals, which I've shown you in the staff report. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. I appreciate that. And I know that it was moving target there for a number of weeks, and I appreciate the effort you made once things sort of coalesced on what to do to get this put together very quickly. These cities are moving forward and holding their respective meetings, and so I see the oversight board pressed into action very soon. So thank you for getting that before us.
You're welcome.
I will open it to the public. I have no request to speak on this item, so I'll close it to the – oops, okay. Please come forward with that, and you can speak and then turn that in so we can get that done.
I'm sorry. I'll be very quick. It's interesting to note that now that the California case management system has been put on hold, if any of that funding that the county still has control over, my question is what portion of that is going to go towards improving – countywide computer systems to keep them accurate and to audit the data that's in these systems, because they found money that they didn't even know they had. Once the administrative office of the court started, you know, trying to figure out how they were going to solidify their data, they found money they didn't even know they had.
Well, hopefully we'll get that all figured out in the next few months.
Mr. Chairman, I think because it's kind of like a will that has nobody, that goes to all the administrators, all that extra money to the different districts? No? Okay.
I'm going to close public comment and bring it back to the board for action.
Hello? Can't we appoint him to something?
I will move staff recommendation as amended by the staff report today.
Second.
Okay, moved and seconded, and I think we can do this with a voice vote. We can. So all in favor?
Aye. Oh, yeah.
Those opposed? Motion carries.
And I have a meeting at 1:30 on this.
Well, if we don't get with the program, you'll be late. So let's move it along here. Next item, Madam Clerk. Introduce it, please.
Item number 20, approved project delivery and construction agreement and Correction Standards Authority jail construction agreement, allowing the Sheriff's Women's Jail project to move through the state lease bond process.
Very good. And we have Chief Rob Reed and Katie Perez from General Services giving the staff report. Chief Reed.
Good morning, Chairman and board members. It's on? Okay. It says it's on. On February 22, 2011, a little over a year ago, an update and status report for the new women's jail and jail medical facility project was provided to the board. The board received the update and status report and directed staff to restart the women's jail project and begin negotiations with the state on contracts necessary to obtain AB 900 funding. Today we bring before you the contracts necessary to begin moving through the state lease bond process as administered by the State Department of Finance and the State Public Works Board. Say that correctly. This project is on the consent agenda for tomorrow's State Public Works Board meeting to, quote, recognize the project. The contracts, if approved today, will be before them on May 11th. A recent delay by the state in delivering those contracts to us prevented them from being at tomorrow's meeting. However, they will go forward on May 11th, 2012. This does not delay our project. There will be additional contracts to be approved and signed once we are further along with the project, and we'll bring those to you as they become needed. One issue to take note of is that staffing of the project will mostly come from staff hired due to AB 109 realignment funding. The numbers before you may seem large, but they do cover a 30-year period. Ms. Katie Perez and I are here to answer any questions you may have, as are other staff members in the audience.
Very good. Thank you, Chief Reed. Just a comment, and we talked about it just briefly earlier today, and that is we describe this project as an expansion of the women's jail, but it's really much more than that. That's going to benefit men and women who are incarcerated in the facility as well as improve the security. So could you speak just briefly about the additional pieces of this project?
I'd be more than happy to. The first thing I'll talk about is the security electronics program. Right now our jail is operating on five different systems. They're very antiquated, and it's kind of like a Winchester mystery house, as I frequently describe the place. This will give us one security electronic system over the entire facility. It's all integrated such that it will work. It's not parts that we have to special order or something. It'll be more off-the-shelf type parts, whereas today we're dealing with some vendors who are no longer in business, and you know, we're having a few difficulties with that. The other portion is the what we call the medical, mental health, and programs portion, which actually creates space within the jail to have programs to where we can take some of the inmates and give them things, give them training, classes that help reduce their recidivism, make them so that they're more able to go back into society and not come back and revisit us again.
So. Great. That's good. I think it's important that the public know that it's more than just expanding the women's jail to incarcerate more women, but to provide other needed services and security out at the facility. I'll open it to the public. I have no request to speak on this item, so I'll bring it back to the board. Congratulations. We're finally moving it forward, and thank you for your perseverance.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll move on to our next item. Madam Clerk.
Item number 21, a request to approve a revised ordinance amendment entitled Menacing and Aggressive Animals.
And we have Health Agency Director Jeff Hamm at the computer, and Dr. Eric Anderson, I guess, leading us on this item. Dr. Anderson or
yes,
Mr. Hamm? Oh, Dr. Anderson. Okay. Hey, you seem to be able to work the computer okay, Mr. Hamm?
Yeah,
Very good.
Mr. Hamm, there's a little mouse that's running loose down there somewhere. Oh.
Is it aggressive? The mouse trap.
Yep.
All right. I think I'm ready to start. Good morning. I'm Eric Anderson, the Animal Services Manager. This is the second hearing that we've had on this item, aggressive and menacing animal ordinance. The last hearing that we had, if you'll recall, was on March 6th of this year. And at that presentation, following discussion and some comment, your board asked us to go back and make some revisions and adjustments to the ordinance as it was proposed to bring a couple of additional provisions and abilities into play. But just as way of background, if you'll recall, we spent some of that discussion outlining what the current statutes and codes related to aggressive animals and some of the tools the Animal Services has at our disposal in dealing with those. And what we've come to identify is that there exists a gap right now between when we first identify an animal as a potential public safety risk and when we actually have something in play that we can use to take an affirmative action to control those animals and make an effort to get some additional public safety secured away there. So some of the specific types of examples that we're currently not able to address are situations in which we've identified a dog as being aggressive, but it actually has not yet attacked a person or engaged in an attack on a person. But there seems to be a reasonable concern that that's just an eventuality. A classic example that we hear of regularly is a situation where a person may say, look, you know, my neighbor's dog is just highly aggressive. Every time my son's out in the backyard, it charges the fence. It's got dry rot and it's falling down, but it just hasn't been able to push the boards out yet and hasn't come out. I'm afraid of letting my child out to play in the yard. I don't want to go out and garden and so forth. Until the animal's actually succeeded in attacking somebody, there's not a lot we can do, though, currently. So what we wind up with is advising that individual that, you know, they're going to need to call us back once the animal does come off property. And at that point, then we can look at some of these ordinances and laws that we have in place. Most specifically, the sections that we deal with now are under the State Food and Ag Code, under potentially dangerous dogs and vicious dogs. Those two sections allow us to actually get a designation on an animal in a judicial order, which will either require that the animal be confined in conditions that are set forward by the court and usually in compliance with something that our office has recommended, or in some cases may actually result in the euthanasia of the animal as well. The process of getting there, though, is somewhat cumbersome. It requires that we file a petition with the court, conduct a hearing, present testimony and evidence, and then go through a rebuttal and hopefully prevail in that case, then getting a judicial order. The criteria that allow us to get to the point of seeking a petition are relatively specific as well and also relatively significant, so that they require us to establish a track record of repetitive behavior for these animals, and that also contributes to the gap, so that until we've actually established that history, we're left with little that we can do. One of the other situations that we deal with relatively regularly or frequently are situations in which an animal may actually escape and attack and injure another animal severely, or even in some situations kill another animal. Unfortunately, if that's the first time that happens, it's more or less of a freebie. There's not a whole lot that we have in our toolbox to address that in an affirmative manner. We can certainly document the event, contact the owner of the animal, and give them a warning. But in terms of actually possibly be things like large snakes, but conceivably some other animals as well. So in addressing that gap, then, we presented the menacing aggressive animal ordinance, and as it was discussed a month ago, the ordinance would have, as it was initially presented, require owners to ensure that animals which are aggressive are securely confined. And it doesn't do anything to preclude or prohibit somebody from owning an aggressive animal. We recognize that there's situations in which a person may have a legitimate reason or desire to do so. What the ordinance does say is that if somebody does have an animal which is aggressive, that it's their responsibility to ensure that it is secured and confined in a manner which will ensure it doesn't escape and represent a threat to the public safety and the general public at large. Additionally, the ordinance established penalties for the owners of animals which actually do go off property and either severely injure or kill another animal. And again, right now, our ability to address those situations is limited to the potentially dangerous ordinances, which allow us to, once we get to that point, have an animal confined for the future, but it doesn't do anything in terms of any sort of punitive or corrective measures in place or penalties to the animal owner that has been negligent up to that point. Based on the discussion and comments from a month ago, your board asked us to go back and address a couple of items. Most specifically, there were four things that you requested that we look at, and so that's the items here to discuss today. One of the first items that you asked us to do was to go back and include a bit more specific or clarified language with regards to key terms in the ordinance, most specifically what constitutes an aggressive animal and what's a menacing animal. The definition of severe bodily injury was previously in the ordinance, and that remains unchanged in the new section here as well. But we have added an addition or a definition for an aggressive animal as one which is an animal whose behavior indicates it's prone to unprovoked attacks against a person or another animal, and then as a menacing animal being one which, through its behavior, demonstrates an intention to inflict harm or otherwise place a person in reasonable fear for his or her safety or the safety of animals kept by him or her. I would take a moment to point out that both of these are specific to behavior demonstrated by the animal in question, so they would be assessed by the behavior which is described by the person who's the complainant in the case, as well as the assessment of the animal control officers responding and their interpretation of the behavior of the animal. So each situation would be based on a case-by-case evaluation and specific to the behavior of the animal rather than simply placing a broad classification of any individual group of animals, a breed or a species as a whole. The second point that you asked us to look at was the fines that were associated with the violation of the ordinance. Initially, the ordinance was set up with compliance on the county code, which established a minimum violation or a maximum penalty for violations at, I believe it was $50, $100, and $250 for sequential offenses. Based on the significance of some of the issues that we might be dealing with, there seemed to be consensus that was maybe a little bit too lenient. You asked us to go back and look at increasing the fees with possible maximum going up to $750 or $1,000. In reviewing this with County Council, we identified a section of the California Government Code which caps any infraction from being fined at an amount more than $500. So that essentially limits our ability to go beyond $500 for any infraction. So we've set we did increase the penalties for violation, but had to go with that cap. So at this point now, a first violation would be $100, $200, and then $500 for sequential violations. We did clarify within the language of the ordinance as well, though, that each 24 hours that a violation remained in existence would constitute a new event. So that, in theory, then, should a problem remain unabated, a person could get a citation on day one, day two, and day three, and quite quickly be at $800 for their violations, and then continue to accrue $500 a day until they actually did come into compliance. The third item that you asked us to look at was establishing a liability for property owners and landlords for situations in which tenants were identified as having an aggressive animal but weren't taking adequate measures for ensuring that it was confined and keeping it enclosed properly. The provision circumstances, I would anticipate they wouldn't be issuing any citations. The point being more for those conditions that remain unattended. I would make one side note on this provision in that I think it's well intended. Some of the comments our office has received, and one of the points that occurred to me in consideration of this is that there is a potential for an unintended consequence of this this individual subsection, in that the housing market and rental market for tenants with pets is pretty tight as it is currently. There is some degree of question as to whether or not landlords may just simply further tighten up on a prohibition of pets in response to this, and even those that have, you know, well-behaved and well-mannered animals may find the rental landscape a little bit more challenging than currently, and there is some concern that may result in some increased turn-ins to the shelter or difficulty in finding rental housing. The final point that you asked us to look at was for providing for confinement of an animal or a requirement that an animal be confined at either a veterinary or a boarding facility following a second notice of the violation. And in discussing that and reviewing it with county council, it led to some question as to whether or not that may infringe upon certain due process requirements and be in conflict with certain sections of the state code governing the seizure of animals in California. But we recognize that as an important consideration as well. So in trying to, I think, attend to that concern, yet be in compliance with the due process and seizure requirements, what we did was inserted Section B, which says that following notification of a violation, animal owners must immediately confine the animal to an enclosure or location which mitigates the aggressive and menacing behavior. That allows the animal to stay in the custody of the animal owner and gets us around the due process and seizure requirements, but it does place an immediate requirement on the owner to remove the animal from the problem enclosure and secure it away until that enclosure is fixed or amended. So the animal owner may actually choose to keep the animal enclosed inside the house or a garage. They certainly have at their option placing it in a boarding kennel or a veterinary facility. They may place it in family or friends or something like that as well, but that got us around the conflict of the seizure requirements, yet still requiring the animal owners to immediately confine the animal. And in fact, the way that we've set that would be on the first violation as opposed to the second, that they were immediately required to confine the animal securely. So those were the four items that you've asked us to amend or include in the way they're set up in the ordinance as it is. I'd be glad to take any questions or comments you have on that.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. We do have some questions from the board. Supervisor Hill, followed by Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, a question for County Council. As Dr. Anderson spelled out, because we had gotten some feedback, some people who wanted us to make it somehow stronger on some of the on some of the fines and such. What other recourse would a person have if, in fact, their animal were attacked by another animal, or killed, or a child, or anyone else? What other just so people know that this isn't the only thing available to them if necessary.
Thank you. Rita Neal, Assistant County Counsel. The other options that animal owners would have are civil remedies. And in fact, the law with regard to civil remedies when an animal or child or person is injured are fairly strict. So granted, they would have to go through the legal system, but the law is very stringent in order to try and protect people from vicious animals from a civil standpoint. So there are other options besides this ordinance that people could pursue, whether they decide to pursue it depending on the amount of damages in small claims court, which is a fairly simple process, or through the Superior Court system.
Right. Okay. So I think that's just important for people to understand, too. We're trying to do everything we can, mostly on the preventative side as much as anything, but if there is some kind of tragedy that occurs, there are recourse for greater punishment from the court system. Okay.
Thank you, Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you. Thank you, Supervisor Hill, for raising that point. And I'm glad that Dr. Anderson raised the other issue about the item F, the concerns relative to an unintended consequence, if you will. That was raised in my own home, actually, but
speeding or something like that, similar to many traffic infractions. The citation itself is something that you have the right to contest and can go to court and present your case as to why you don't feel that it's a valid citation. That would require our officer also to attend and present information as to what they observed the conditions to be, why they felt there was actually a valid issue and a valid concern. And then a judge can actually make a decision as to whether or not, that is in fact a proper citation or there was in fact a violation that exists there. So a person does have the right to actually challenge, and it's not solely up to the animal control officer to dictate what happens. With regards to your question about, what if somebody doesn't actually pay the fines, in a general sense, if they don't pay the fines, they don't show up for court, then they're basically not in appearance. The court can issue a bench warrant for their arrest, and they can be taken into custody until that issue is clarified.
Thank you for that clarification. There was some question in my district about this ordinance not having any teeth, and that clarifies it and explains it all. Thank you very much.
Okay, no further questions from my colleagues. So I'll open it to the public, and I do have a number of requests to speak. We'll begin with Robin O'Hara, followed by Casey DeClercq.
My name's Robin O'Hara, and I'm a resident of Napomo, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to all of you. I'm here today to reinforce the fact that this ordinance, I would like to see the first offense be the $500 fine. And I'm coming from firsthand experience. March 22nd of this year, I was walking my dog, as we always do, around 14 acres of open space behind our neighborhood, and came upon Live Oak Ridge Road and Villa Nona, and my dog and I were viciously attacked by two loose pit bulls. And the one dog, the most aggressive dog, grabbed the neck of my dog. I was in the middle of it, holding on and trying to beat off these dogs. The other dog was biting my dog's back leg. And it was just a horrendous attack. And my neighbor, I was screaming for help. There was nobody, that I could see that could help me. And my neighbor finally came out, and he grabbed a shovel and beat the one pit bull over the head four times before the pit bull let go of my dog's ear and neck. There was no doubt in my mind, if that neighbor didn't come out and rescue us, that they would have killed my dog. It was a horrible, horrible attack. We called the sheriff's department. I called my husband because I had to get my dog to the vet. And the neighbor went and found where the dogs resided and spoke to the owner of the animals. And then the animal control people came out and interviewed myself and also the owner of the two dogs. But what we found out and was so terrifying was that those dogs had been out all night. They had broken through a window in their home to chase after another neighborhood dog. And then after that, the owner said that he tried to look for them but gave up. And so those dogs were out all night long. and into the morning. I walk at 7:45 in the morning. So this, and that's when the attack happened. And there could have been small children out. There could have been other animal walkers. You know, there's people in my neighborhood. We're all terrified now. I had to go out and get pepper spray if I intended to want to walk further in my neighborhood. And this animal owner, he's only a couple blocks away. He's never once called me to see how my dog is, how we are doing. Never has shown any type of communication. Found out also that he's a renter and that the owner of the property, same thing, we sent him a letter telling him about the attack and that these animals were on his, that he's, his renter has these vicious dogs. Mm-hmm. And haven't heard anything from him. So I'm just here to say that I just want the ordinance to go through and to really have consequences for the owner of the pets as well as the person that lets them rent.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. O'Hara. Casey DeClercq, followed by Martha Golden.
My name is Casey DeClercq, and I live in Cayucas, California. To people having problems finding housing, there are a lot of ways to address this concern. I'm impressed that Mrs. O'Hara was able to get animal control to her house. I have never been able to get them out there, even after my dogs were bitten by an off-leash dog. I never even got a phone call back. So I would like to see animal control, instead of passing by the golden retriever that's off leash and not doing anything, address that. Go work under the laws you already have. Because what they don't know, and I've seen animal control drive past the off leash golden retriever, is that golden retriever ripped open the throat of another dog. And it didn't make it into the media. It still happened. And if the dog had been on leash, it wouldn't have happened. Enforce your existing laws before you hold people accountable for a mistake their dog might make in the future, because there's no way that you can accurately predict which dogs will attack, and if they're confined under the existing laws, you don't need to add any more laws.
Thank you, Ms. DeClercq. Martha Golden, followed by Lisa Wallander.
Thank you. I can't concur more with the previous speaker. The perfect example of how this ordinance would do nothing except threaten people who have perfectly well-controlled animals and are very responsible dog owners was the first speaker, who had a tragic incident occur to her, but there's nothing that would have prevented that in this ordinance, nothing at all. Breaking through a window, that those dogs were properly confined inside a house. And yet, they broke out and in one incident did some very serious damage. This ordinance would have done nothing about that. Last time I spoke in opposition to this ordinance because I said it was well-intentioned, but that was on the road that was paved with good intentions to terrible legislation. Dr. Anderson made it very clear today that what animal control wants is to avoid any due process issues that animal control has to deal with. That means there's nothing in the ordinance that tells you when they have to respond, how they are going to define the animal as potentially dangerous when they come out, if they ever do, after the first incident, whether or not the phone call from terrified person who's scared to death because all black dogs, truth is a defense, I own two large black dogs, always adequately defined and never off-leash outdoors ever, except in my own backyard with two gates. How do you define it after the fact? Do they come out and see it? When they get the second phone call the next day, do they say, oh, we got that phone call yesterday, so we get to issue another citation? There's nothing that smacks of due process in this ordinance, but there's plenty that tells me that animal control wants to exercise a little more muscle willy-nilly that will not protect the public. And I will also point out that this ordinance makes it very unclear whether you're talking about dogs that are actually actually within their own property or walking out on the street, obeying the leash law. They're leashed. And as Supervisor Hill said at the first hearing, he had great concern because there was a small dog, I think he said Chihuahua, but I could be wrong, that seemed very aggressive to him, but he wasn't too concerned when walking his dog because it was a small dog. Please, this is no good.
Thank you, Judge Golden. Lisa Wallander, followed by Giselle Naylor.
Lisa Wallander, Los Osos. Good morning, Honorable Supervisors. I am one of those people who believes I will be safer as a consequence of this ordinance, and I'm grateful to you for directing staff to strengthen it, and I want to convey my thanks to Dr. Anderson for revising it accordingly. Please pass this ordinance as written. It is now strong enough that it can help protect the public from aggressive animal attacks. Please do not allow any changes that may weaken it. As I mentioned during the first hearing on this ordinance 3 months ago, a dog on the rental property next door to me broke through a fence board and bared its teeth at me while snarling and growling. Although I have nicely asked the renters and the property owners to make sure the dog can't get through the fence to attack me, and have been told the fence would be repaired and reinforced, nothing has been done to date. That was 3 months ago. I appreciate knowing that I may be a dog, and which outweighs the other. As a side note, I saw an online petition protesting this ordinance. If you should be presented with this petition, please make a note on two things about it. First, the description of the ordinance was very inaccurate and misleading. And second, the signatures are not local. I looked at the first 200 names of people who signed this petition, and not a single one was in San Luis Obispo County, and very few were even in California. Again, thank you for strengthening this ordinance. Please pass it as written, and do not allow any changes to weaken it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wallander. Giselle Naylor.
Hi, my name is Giselle Naylor. I'm from Oceano, and I come to these meetings and focus my attention on a lot of items rather than come every meeting and speak to one. So thank you for hearing me out. There are two things missing from this ordinance. I don't think it's necessary. I think, like the previous speakers have said, state law and civil remedies provide a remedy. The examples that were mentioned here is where there's a clear history of aggression of the animals, and the ordinance speaks to things that are unseen and leaves arbitrary discretion up to the officer, and that can be used in a malicious way, and it has been used in a malicious way. I have a personal knowledge of having a $100 fine, a notice to pay fine that I was supposed to pay, get sent to the wrong address by the court. So I never received that notice. And the next thing I knew, the sheriffs were kicking my door in, did $1,000 worth of damage to the door. I get brought to jail. I've got a dog. My dog gets taken to animal services. And then my lawyer comes to court. They agree the case should be dismissed. But in the meantime, in order to get me to plead to, you know, something I didn't do, which was, you know, there was a question when they realized that, whoops, the county sent notice to pay fine to the wrong address. Therefore, you know, why did her door get kicked in? You know, she wasn't guilty of not paying this fine. The notice when they had, I was listed in the phone book and they had my address, the prosecuting authority managed to send the notice to the wrong address. My dog gets put in jail, but Judge LaBarbera holds me over in jail for another week. The prosecutor asked Judge LaBarbera to kill my animals. And I said, if I don't get out within 12 days, they're going to kill my dogs. And Judge LaBarbera says, oh, you've got nothing going. You can wait another week. So I had to pay $1,000 to get out of jail to save my dogs. So that's the way that, you know, some ordinances can be used in a malicious way to keep people from arguing, why was my door kicked in when it shouldn't have been because the county made a mistake? You see what I mean? This ordinance can allow an official to use arbitrary discretion to put an animal down when the animal did nothing wrong, just to shut the owner up from making a claim or an issue that's related to, you know, their point of view. What I don't see is any opportunity to train a dog.
Thank you, Ms. Naylor, your time.
In this ordinance. And is the dog property or a human being? There's never any discussion.
Thank you. That concludes my request to speak during public comment on this item. So I'll close it to public comment and bring it back to the board and go to Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I understand some of the concerns that people have expressed on occasion, including today, about how something could or couldn't, I mean, there's nothing that can perfectly prevent anything, but this does give us something that can prevent some of the more common menacing and aggressive behaviors that people have. I've heard from quite a few constituents, and also as somebody who walks my dogs every day, several times a day, downtown, around downtown area, there are many occasions when there are instances that perfectly fit. I can think of probably half a day. I can think of streets that I avoid because of it, where it is literally a fence that has the problems in terms of it, you know, it being rotted out or there being gaps, and the concern is that a dog will be able to break free and attack. And this allows us to actually do something about that, not necessarily to punish people, but to say, you know, the first thing is to notify them and say, this is the problem. You need to have this addressed. And I guess, you know, I understand the concerns about the rental market and allowing pets. And, I've thought about that myself. I think it's certainly something that's an important consequence to consider, but I'm not sure how else we would get the that we should have done. I'm glad that we're moving forward with it. If it protects and I think it will protect a fair number of people, and I don't think people should have to be terrorized while walking their dogs, even if they're not attacked. I don't think I think that, you know, if a dog is in its yard and it often does act aggressively, just dogs will, okay. You can make a decision whether there's an actual threat, and that's what animal control can do, whether there's a problem with the fence, whether there's a problem with the way the dog is contained. Those are things that I think we need the ability to enforce on. And so I'm certainly supportive and certainly interested in talking about if we truly think the landlord thing is going to make it hard for renters.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you. I think oftentimes, too, and I think Judge Golden pointed it out, I know far too often we focus on pit bulls as the menacing dog that's out there, but there are others that can fit that criteria as well. And oftentimes I would think a landlord may not know that somebody actually does have a dog that becomes aggressive at some point in time. But Dr. Anderson, I wonder if you would, based upon some of the comments that were made today, how the current ordinance affects what our abilities are and what the proposed ordinance will do to remedy that.
Well, you know, some of the questions as to whether or not this actually has a preventative ability, that it's true it wouldn't have prevented necessarily Mrs. O'Hara's situation. I would mention that we, in addition to Ms. O'Hara's case, though, we have had one or two others in the last month since we've met in which this ordinance would have been applied. In Ms. O'Hara's case, it may have been applied in terms of the penalty for allowing an animal to actually cause injury to another animal. So while it necessarily wouldn't have done anything preventative in that circumstance, there may have been a negative and adverse consequence for the animal owner, which at this point we're not applying anything because there is nothing that fits that current circumstance. In terms of the preventative question, it's not, I think Supervisor Hill mentioned, and I think he's certainly right, that it's not going to prevent every circumstance in every event. I think it's almost, it would be impossible and unreasonable to say that this is going to just make everything you know, go away. And there's always going to be those circumstances where animals are able to escape containment. And in some cases, maybe not even because of negligence. You know, the three-year-old leaves a gate open or something like that. But this does give us, in situations where we do know that there is a potential problem, and we can say, hey, there is an issue that exists and a potential for an aggressive encounter to occur, it gives us a tool then to address that situation and compel an animal owner to correct their fencing or their containment system for the animal. And in that context, yes, it does have some preventative ability. So while it won't prevent every circumstance, right now we're not preventing any circumstances. And so this will at least put us forward in that situation. So, you know, with regards to the question of discretion and enforcement and so on, I think I mentioned at the initial hearing that for most contacts that we have, the initial presentation is educational and directive and helping people identify that, look, there is a concern with this enclosure. Here are recommendations on what you need to do to come into compliance with that. And then that if measures aren't taken, the person may be cited there. So it gives us an opportunity to sort of work and help promote people at coming into compliance with the requirements. The animal control officers would certainly make a decision about the animal's behavior and whether the behavior that it's one that the complainant is describing, but just as importantly, the behavior that they observe at the time that they're out there, as well as evaluation of the type of containment for the animal and its physical condition and abilities and whether or not it could, you know, reasonably be able to push down a fence or climb over something and so on, would be all part of the decision of the officer as to whether or not a citation is appropriate. And it would be part of what somebody could challenge in court if they felt so inclined. The question of, you know, animals behaving aggressively, you know, having a couple of large black dogs that people may feel concerned about just simply by virtue of their color or looking intimidating, and maybe they even do bark protectively or aggressively. In a situation where, you know, somebody says, hey, look, this dog is frightening me because it looks really mean and it barks every time we go by, and the officer looks at it and says, look, it's a protective territorial type of bark, but the dog's adequately contained, and it's not showing a lot of intention to actually and motivation to escape and come out of its enclosure. It's simply saying, hey, don't come into where I'm at because this is my area. The animal control officer in that situation is going to consider that an appropriate set of circumstances, and there wouldn't be any action which would be taken.
Thank you. I think that clarifies some. I'm still a little bit
experiencing, you know, a problem at your property with the animal there and ask for assistance in fixing it. I don't have anything that you know, on our part would compel a landlord to actually take action once they're advised, though.
But I think I defer to legal counsel on that, if we could actually notify somebody about landlords about that. Because, I mean, if you get a letter from the county that's talking about something like this, I would think that they would want to take action.
You would hope. Rita Neal, Assistant County Counsel. One thing about the Section F as it's written now is it is discretionary. It says that the property owner may be held jointly and severally liable. There's, you know, a lot of different ways you could handle this, and understanding the comments with regard to it often takes a long time to evict somebody, you could leave it as it is and leave that up to the discretion of animal services to try and work with the property owner, or you can add some language to make the notice period longer to add some discretion for the animal services officer as long as the landlord is working toward resolving the problem. You know, we could continue to add things in this, or we could rely on discretion of animal services.
And I guess it kind of goes back to the point of, I mean, if I were, which I am a landlord, but if I were a landlord where people were going to rent from me and then all of a sudden they had an animal and I'm not aware of the situation there, then I find myself in the position of being fined or held liable to it, I would probably craft a rental agreement where I would not allow any animals because I don't want that potential liability.
And what I might add, expanding on Ms. Neal's comments, in I mentioned that when we contact the animal owner the first time, that the approach is generally educational, that there's a problem, here's what needs to be done to fix it. That same idea or perspective certainly would be applied to the landlord, that, hey, there's a problem that exists, and requesting assistance in helping. And I think, as you indicated, probably most landlords would take that issue seriously and would move to get some resolution there. And the officer contacting them, I think, you know, in a situation where the landlord says, hey, you know, I am working on correcting it, here's some measures that we've taken, but there's an inherent timeline to compelling them to fix the problem. The eviction process takes so long, or, you know, hey, I've booked a fence company to come out and fix it, but they're booked out, you know, 3 weeks in advance or something like that. Those are all positive measures that somebody is taking and demonstrating towards effecting a solution, and I couldn't, and at that point, you know, the discretionary point of may site would fall into place, and I would anticipate that the officer would say, look, you know, we're moving in the right direction, there's no reason to issue a citation, and it's not getting us anywhere forward. It's just simply those situations where there may be a need to compel some action that we currently don't have a tool for.
Okay. Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, in speaking to the matter of discretion, a lot about this ordinance does depend on the judgment of the animal control officers, but I don't think that's unusual. The application of our general public safety ordinance depends on the judgment and the discretion of sheriff's deputies and fire inspectors and things like that. So I'm not too concerned about that. I trust the professionalism of the folks who do that work for the county. I think there is a preventative aspect to this, because it promotes responsible pet ownership. And in one instance that really hasn't gotten discussion is that the attack of one animal on another will have consequences now for a first time where it doesn't. And I think that's an important message to send. Supervisor Meacham raises a really interesting question. I mean, I think the question of its impact, and particularly its unintended impact on the rental market, on landlords, is interesting. I would wonder, from counsel's perspective, in a general sense of liability, if a landlord fails to maintain a fence, an animal escapes a poorly maintained fence, the landlord knows or should have known that fence was inadequate. I would certainly think that a plaintiff's attorney might be after that landlord for something?
Yes, Rita Neal, Assistant County Counsel. You are correct, Supervisor Gibson. Again, there are civil remedies which would apply to both the animal owner as well as the property owner. And again, your level of which court you find yourself in would depend on the amount of damages.
And so I wonder, from Supervisor Meacham's...
I taught at Cal Poly for 13 years. Before that, I was a student for quite a while, so I know what landlords can be like, especially in a college town. I can, you know, a lot, there are great landlords, and there are landlords who will not fix toilets, showers, or you name it. And, you know, that's one thing, and we don't have control over that per se, but this is something where we have an ability to help on the public safety realm, which is that a menacing and aggressive animal is, in fact, a public safety concern. And this at least allows us to say to a landlord, we need you to be responsible because your renter does have a dog that poses a threat, and we just want to make sure that you take the actions to contain it. I think a good landlord's going to do that. If we don't have any ability to enforce something on a landlord, meaning to be able to fine them in some manner or hold them liable, I think you're going to find a lot of landlords that, just as with the broken toilets and broken showers, just ignore it and figure, well, these students aren't going to get a lawyer and sue me. And, you know, so I think that it's important for us to – we have discretion, so it's not necessarily going to force anybody to do something that's not fair. I think it allows them to which is something I think landlords need to be responsible for, which is ensuring that whoever they rent to doesn't pose any harm, any risk to the public safety. And that's where
I'm at. Can I throw one other thought in there and then let Supervisor Meacham respond? We speculate on what effect this is going to have, and that's really all we can do at this point. I think it might be a reasonable assumption or a reasonable speculation that this might not have so much of an effect on whether a landlord's going to rent to someone with pets. My experience with being a tenant is that landlords rent to folks with pets if they like animals. Landlords don't rent to people with pets if they don't like animals, and that's pretty much a black and white. I think that this simply clarifies the responsibility of a landlord. They have other responsibilities when they rent a property, and I'll yield the floor at that point.
Okay, very good. Supervisor Meacham, did you want to comment?
Well, I don't disagree with the issue of public safety and everything that's been suggested here. I'm just a little bit concerned that there'll be if you have a property, say a property manager that manages several apartments, would they be required, in essence, to provide a disclosure, in a sense, to say that you will be held liable for this, and if anything happens to, from an aggressive standpoint, that they exempt the owner from that and push that off on the property or the people that's renting? And if I were the project manager or the apartment manager, I just blanketly say, I don't want to take that liability, and I would not have animals. And I'm not just talking about just the aggressive animals. I mean, I've had apartments before where I said, I can't have certain animals. We don't have any. And then the next thing I know, when they move out, I don't know who scratched all the walls and all the carpets and everything else, and it was cats. So they're not always upfront about that. But I'm just more concerned that this is going to create that. And you may be right, Supervisor Gibson. It may not be an unintended consequence. We don't know that. But at this point, I'm supportive of everything in here. I'm just not comfortable with that one.
Thank you, Supervisor Meacham. Supervisor Teixeira, and let's try to move this along if we can. We do have a significant closed session after this, unless things have changed since yesterday. But Supervisor Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson, and I echo the comments of my colleagues. The one thing that I think that we're missing here is there needs to be a certain amount of responsibility of the landowner and the tenant, and this is something that they need to work out amongst themselves. I know many people that have rented houses and or apartments and for years and not had any problems, and there's people that are in there 2 or 3 months and you have problems every day. I think in Mrs. O'Hara's case, here's a fine example of the landlord not knowing what's going on in his home that he's renting out. Had he known, they'd have probably made provisions for the animals not to be in the house and or not break the window. I think this is the key thing that we need to look at, is they are responsible and they're aware of what's going on in their rentals.
Yes, I'm just going to not add to the discussion here much. I think we've had a very thorough discussion. This is our second time around here, and we listened during the first hearing, and we made modifications to address the issues that were raised, and I think that we've adequately done that, and I appreciate the effort that staff has taken to address those issues. And as Dr. Anderson said, this will not prevent every circumstance, but now we're not preventing any. And that's really, I think, what we're trying to do here is give us a means of addressing situations that we have experienced, continue to experience. And while there may
nitpick it into a hypothetical realm is to miss the larger point that we want to do, which is to protect the public as best as we can, and this does it. So I move that we approve it.
Second.
It's moved and seconded that we approve this ordinance. And Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Waiving the reading.
Waiving the reading.
Yes.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Meacham.
I'm not going to be able to support it because I can't support that item F. Everything else I'm supportive of. I think that this is an important thing to do, but I cannot support that part.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes. Motion carries. And with that, we'll move on to closed section, but we do have one request to speak. And Ms. Naylor, if you would approach the lectern, please.
Hi, my name is Giselle Naylor. I'm from Oceano, and I'm taking the opportunity to comment on this item as it relates to contracts, and specifically water contracts, because the flood control district case that's mentioned in the closed items session, of course, is accompanied by a lot of different contracts, and some of the contracts have in their wording to the effect that denies access to public inspection and copying of the contracts and of the financial accounting data that goes along with those contracts, and I see a real problem with that. I tried to speak to that issue earlier and was cut off, and I used the Oceano Lagoon, the contract that was mentioned in the March 27th agenda that was supposed to look at how to alleviate flooding in Oceano. That contract, for example, specifically has wording that denies public access, inspection, and copying of those contracts and financial data that accompanies those contracts. The same is true with the flood control district contracts in the particular case that you're going to go into in closed session. So, I would encourage the board to make sure, because you've got so much work, the public wants to assist you in making sure that those contracts are adhered to and that the finances are kept within the bounds of the contracts. And if you don't allow public inspection and copying of those contracts, you've got no input from the public. I know it can be a headache, but a lot of times you've got people who are trained, they're retired, they've got free time, and they want to take closer looks, especially with water contracts and construction contracts. And also you should pay careful attention to wording where the initial contract is a publicly bid contract, and then wording within it says, oh, we can have closed, no bid contracts as the contract gets carried out for the various sections of the project that needs to be completed. I think you should push for more public accountability when it comes to the specifics of the financial accounting that goes along with those contracts, if you get my meaning. There should be more public inspection, whether the contracting party is private or public. The public, by law, should have access to those details. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Naylor. And with that, I'll close public comment and ask.
I'll ask County Council, Ms. Neal, to give us a forecast on the time allotted for closed session.
Approximately 50 minutes today.
5:00? 5:00. Okay, thank you. And we will not have an afternoon session, but we will come back to report out of closed session at 1:30.